On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
There are war stories that are so extraordinary that upon hearing about them originally, you'd swear that this was a made-up story, that it was a novel. But this particular story is not a novel. It's a true story of survival adventure and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. It's Mitch Zukov's Lost in Shangri-La from Harper, an imprint of Harper Collins. And Mitch, it's great to have you on the Bookshelf.
It's great to be here, Dave.
I want to tell you that I first read your book last summer and reviewed it. Far too often I get a book and I think, well, that looks interesting. I'll get around to it a little later. When I got your book, something about it struck me, and not just the clever title, but the extraordinary setup for it. So I did something unusual for me, which I probably do more often, and I just jumped on the book right away. I was so taken by it and so engrossed in the story that I just zipped through it. So it is an extraordinary story, but again, it sounds like something that's invented because it's got so many wild elements to it. Tell us what happened to these servicemen and women back in the latter days of the war in South Pacific. It was not in the last part of the war for our listeners. Our story starts on May the 13th, 1945.
Exactly. Well, Dave, what happened that day was 24 men and women who were stationed on the northern coast of the island of New Guinea decided to take a little bit of an R&R, a rest and relaxation jaunt, a sightseeing trip, really. They worked hard, and this was a little bit of time off. And so all of them wanted to see this place that the Army had found only a year earlier. In the middle of this tropical island of New Guinea, just north of Australia, there turned out there was an enormous valley inhabited by people for whom the Stone Age had never ended. And everyone there in Hollandia, where the base was located, wanted to see it. And so they got aboard a plane, the 24 of them, called the Gremlin Special. And it was supposed to be just a flight overhead. They were going to fly over this valley, look down to see these people who were rumored to be cannibals and headhunters, and fly back to the base. But tragically, the Gremlin Special, on the way into the valley, crashed into a jungle-covered mountain. And 18 of the people aboard were killed instantly. 3 more died soon after, leaving just 3 survivors, 2 men and a woman. Who are now suddenly inside this jungle they had hoped to see only from the air, and suddenly going to have to come face to face with these people they thought they would only be looking at from the safety of their plane.
And that's just the beginning of the story. One of the things that Mitch brings out in the tale is that one of the men who survived, and that was Lieutenant John McCollum, lost his twin brother when the airplane crashed. So we
this
have
is a, really tragic, yes.
Here they thought they were going to have this pleasant little romp, a little fun before they get back to the business of war. A horrible tragedy occurs.
Yeah. John McCollum and Robert McCollum were known as the Inseparables, and they were, in fact, inseparable twin brothers, 24 years old. But they were the last two to board the Gremlin Special, and Robert could only find a seat up near the cockpit, and John found a seat near the tail, and that 20 feet of separation or so ends up separating them forever. So when John McCollum, incredibly, when he emerges in the jungle, he's completely unhurt. In fact, he went into the plane twice to pull out 2 Women's Army Corps members who sadly died, but who were still alive, and he tried to rescue them. But when all that sort of excitement wore off, he looked around and realized for the first time in his life he was alone. Mm. And then he was not literally alone because the other 2 survivors were there, and they needed him because they were hurt. Ken Decker was a guy, a sergeant from the upper northwest, and he had a terrible head wound. He would, as long as he lived, he would never remember anything of the flight, anything of the day before that he emerged in the jungle. And so he needed help. And then the third was Margaret Hastings, this beautiful Women's Army Corps corporal from upstate New York, who was just there for a good time, there for a sightseeing trip, and suddenly there she is. She's shoeless. Her shoes were either blown off or burned off in the wreck, and in the jungle with burns on her legs and on her back, and has to wear the shoes of her dead best friend if she's going to survive in the jungle. So the 3 of them really turn to each other and realize we've got to stick together. They have no food. They have just candy charms and a little bit of water. And all of this, as you mentioned, it's too good for me to have made up. And all of this is true and documented in Margaret's diary, in interviews that taped interviews before he died with John McCollum. And what was facing them was essentially the most primitive people on Earth, people who were rumored to be headhunters but were in fact cannibals. That was known to be true. And here we are in their jungle.
Two of the three of us are pretty grievously injured. I mean, a burn, and Sergeant Decker had his backside had gotten terribly burned, and Margaret Hastings' legs were burned. So you have two of the three of them who are badly enough injured that, not even counting the head wound that that Decker had, that in a jungle situation, infection could set in just a matter of hours. And they're in the middle of all this. If it wasn't even for the cannibals that surround them, just surviving the jungle itself is going to be a pretty significant effort. And none of these guys are trained in jungle warfare particularly. Certainly not in, they've never been dropped in a jungle before and told to get their way out with just a hatchet in their hand or something. So that none of them are really prepared for the ordeal that's before them.
Exactly. I mean, the most preparation they had was maybe John McCollum was an Eagle Scout. And, you know, becoming an Eagle Scout in Missouri is a lot different than suddenly trying to survive in the jungle of New Guinea.
Yeah, absolutely. And taking nothing away from Eagle Scouts, because I'm one too, but there's a big difference. There's a big difference, like you say, from camping out and in familiar settings and then being dumped in a place where you have not even really sure how to find your way, and if you do know how to find your way, how far are you away from any place where somebody might find you? If you're in the middle of a carpet like that, how in the world is a rescue plane going to find you in this jungle? All they'll see is a destroyed wreck of a plane and figure everybody died in the plane wreck.
Exactly. If they could even see it, because as you said, it's almost like a carpet. It's a canopy of green, and the plane was effectively under it. And so John McCollum makes the first of many, many great decisions that he makes. And he realizes that they have to violate the usual rule of stay with the plane. He realizes that if they do that, they're never going to be seen. So he salvages a yellow tarp from the tail section of the Gremlin Special, and they start making their way down the mountain, down through a stream, because he got to a high point and saw that there was a clearing some miles down the mountain. He said, well, at least if we can get to the clearing, maybe we can signal any plane that comes overhead. And so he leads them through the jungle, down this river for over several days to get there, and he does, in fact, set out this yellow tarp, and it's almost like it becomes a beacon in this green jungle. And fortunately for them, incredibly good fortune, a bomber that's flying overhead looks down and sees this yellow tarp and realizes there are survivors from the Gremlin Special. But that just is the beginning, because we have so many beginnings in a way, because
yes.
Then it's a question of, okay, how are we going to get people down to help them? They're suddenly surrounded by tens of thousands of Stone Age tribesmen, and the idea of flying over Gremlin Special, over the Shangri-La Valley, was because there was no way to land there. There was no way in or out that anybody could find. And so the question became, we have to get people to them. How do we do that? And then how, if at all, how can we get them out 150 miles through jungle back to the coastline where the American base was?
We're talking to Mitch Zukov, the author of Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II. It's from Harper Books, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. So here we are. We've got three survivors from 24 people that were in this C-47 Skytrain, Joy Flying, and it crashes in the jungle. Two of them are pretty badly injured. The third lost his twin brother in the crash, so they're all pretty broken up emotionally or physically. And there's two Stone Age tribes who fight each other all the time in this valley and occasionally eat each other. And this is the only hope they have of survival. This is going to be intriguing. And there's a pretty large culture shock going on here from both sides.
Exactly.
The way that the Stone Age tribes dress right off the bat is pretty extraordinary and fairly brief.
The Stone Age tribesmen, these are members of the Dani and Yali tribes, and these are people, to give you a sense of them, these are people who have not yet discovered the wheel. They have no textiles, and as you said, Dave, what they end up wearing, in the absence of any kind of clothing, are gourds, hollowed-out gourds that they grow, would be used to cover the men's genitals. Women would kind of wrap a piece of twine around their hips for just modesty is almost too strong a word. And that was their world. They had no utensils. They didn't even use bowls, so to speak. They just sort of ate out of a leaf. And they raised pigs and sweet potatoes and for sustenance. And as you said, they were in constant warfare with each other. The only good piece of luck, an enormous piece of great fortune for the three survivors, is that it turns out, and I learned this when I went to New Guinea and interviewed tribe members who were still there, there was a legend. They had a culture like all cultures, and they had stories. And one of their stories was that there was a Uluwayek legend, they called it, that told that someday light-skinned ghosts or spirits would come down a rope from the sky. And the first tribesman who encountered these three survivors was a guy named Wimayuk Wandik. And Wimayuk Wandik, whose son I met and who was there with Wimayuk when this all took place in the jungle, Wimayuk believed that these three survivors were the embodiment of the Uluwayek legend. And so as a result, he went against his first nature, which was to kill and eat them, and instead he welcomed them to his jungle. And this was just, you know, this remarkable meeting of prehistory and modern history. The Atomic Age and the Stone Age came together in this little clearing. And fortunately for Margaret and John and Ken Decker, there was a legendary tribal legend that told that these people were expected.
Amazing. Once again, it really does seem like there's divine providence all along that keeps watching out for this this handful of people. I was fascinated by some of the customs of these people. One that in mourning, women would chop off the tip of a finger. And the more fingertips they had missing, the more loss they've had. But people didn't apparently live real long in either of these cultures. So I guess they never got to the point of having no working fingers. They smeared themselves with mud when they were in mourning. And so when they saw the uniforms that these three are wearing, they just assumed that since they were sort of brownish, that they must be mud. And then when they touched them and realized, wow, they're not slick and they're not wet, what kind of crazy mud is this? Amazing.
I love the story you just told because it leads to one of the first things that happens after the survivors are found. A group of paratroopers jump in, led by a friend of mine now, Earl Walter, who's still alive at 91. He'll turn 91 later this month. And Earl and 10 other paratroopers jump into the valley to protect the three survivors, wearing, just as you said, these khaki uniforms. And, Earl spent the next 50 years or so telling the story about this and how the tribespeople, when they encountered him, they kept rubbing up and down his body. They rubbed his uniform. And he always believed, and so did his 10 men who were with him, they believed that they thought they were women. And he thought they were making love, as he put it, to them. And when I went back to New Guinea and I asked the tribespeople about this, they said, no, we knew they weren't women. We had never seen clothing before. That was what was so remarkable to us. So you have all these wonderful sort of cultural misunderstandings on both sides.
We have these Filipino paratroopers and medics led by an American son of a war hero who are going in to rescue the survivors. They discover the kind of shape that the survivors are in. Happily enough, the tribesmen don't eat them either. And they leave them to do their work, and they're going to nurse these three survivors back to health. And they've been in the jungle for a while by the time they get there. How long were they lost before the paratroopers were able to come in to treat them?
It was more than a week until the first group, the first two medics, arrive. And then together they're there for another almost 7 weeks, trying to both get the survivors into good enough shape where they can walk out of the jungle to the big valley of Shangri-La, and also figure out how do we get them out.
Yeah, that's right, because then we come on the next little issue. You can parachute in, but how do you get them out? Even if they're well enough, even if they're healed, how do you get them out? And this is where the ingenuity of the American military starts free associating and brainstorming, and they came up with a number of pretty interesting and several really scary scenarios as to how they might rescue the survivors and also the paratroopers who are now there on the ground as well. Everybody's got to get out of there. It just gets more complicated as it goes.
Each one, it was almost like guys at a chalkboard saying, helicopters, yeah, that's a good idea. Well, no, they can't. They didn't have the lift back then to get over the mountains and into the valley, cross it off.
Yeah.
They thought about little spotter planes. No, those don't have the range, and they can only take one person at a time, and you'd have to drop an enormous cache of gasoline into the valley, cross it off. What about Navy blimps, cross it off? And one after another. And they end up coming up with this idea that is just, it's almost something out of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner kind of stuff.
Yes, yes.
We're going to take these giant gliders, and we're going to drop them into the valley, these giant cargo gliders. And then with them, we're going to send materials you could use to make a giant football goalpost, effectively, or something that looks like that. And then you string across the top of the goalpost a giant rubber band, and attach the other end of the rubber band to the nose of the glider. And then we're going to send planes into the valley 15 feet off the valley floor with hooks on their bellies to go through the goalpost, snatch the rubber band off the top, and keep going and pull that glider from a standing start up into the air and up back over the mountains and back to Hollandia, the base, 150 miles away. This is a rescue plan that sounds like it's designed to increase the casualties.
Exactly. I can just see Acme on the base of the glider, you know?
Exactly.
This is the one that they thought was going to work. The ones that Mitch mentioned, there's also one that he didn't mention called dropping in a flying Jeep. And then another was dropping in the CBs to build a landing strip so they could then fly in a C-47, however long that would take. But this is the one that they settled on because they think it's got the best chance of getting everybody out of there. And I'm imagining that the paratroopers, when they found out about this, were thinking, oh, it's terrific, because they had some problems with this. They tested it, right? And it didn't go so well.
One after another. I mean, this snatch technique had been developed earlier, but it had never been tried at this altitude. It had never been tried in these conditions. And on top of that, these gliders had already acquired a really unfortunate nickname in World War II. They were called the Flying Coffin.
Hmm.
And so, again, if you have a plane called the Flying Coffin, take the next flight.
Yeah.
Policy.
Doesn't instill a great amount of confidence in the mission in which you're going to be
not at all
risking
and
your lives.
Earl Walter was so funny when I was interviewing him. He was like, I was perfectly fine at that point marching through 150 miles of cannibal, jungle, rather than getting on that thing.
Yeah.
And he still marvels that was the plan they came up with. But that's the way they thought back then. And that was, it was sort of a can-do spirit, as you said, American ingenuity. We do call this the greatest generation. I guess that was part of the reason why. They believed they could do it, and they gave it a shot.
Now, all the while this is going on, they also are dealing with what we might consider kind of a modern situation, and that is the press getting a whiff of this story and writing their reports and sending them to newspapers and radio stations back home. This became an enormous, we might say, media circus, didn't it?
Very much so. Everyone, I think it was in part because it was definitely ratcheted up by Margaret's presence.
Right.
The idea of a beautiful woman in a lost valley surrounded by Stone Age tribesmen with no way out. I mean, it did, this was an age when in the movies there was Dorothy L'Amour playing, the Jungle Girl. And so it seemed like a work of Warner Brothers come to life. And so reporters just absolutely fastened on this story, and they were writing every day, and it was really frankly, for me as a researcher and a writer, enormously helpful because they were developing the story as it was unfolding. Now, and then in the midst of this, because of these press reports, a filmmaker decides to drop in, which is maybe the craziest thing. I keep saying maybe the craziest thing because there's so many of these elements. And this guy, Alexander Kahn, he's this Hollywood washout of an actor. He was a drinking buddy of Humphrey Bogart's. And Alexander Kahn ends up going to work for the Netherlands, the Dutch government in exile during World War II, as a filmmaker. And because this was taking place on the island of Dutch New Guinea, he said, hey, that's my beat. I should go record this and report about this. And Alexander Kahn takes about a half-hour paratrooper lesson from one of Earl Walter's friends and gets absolutely rip-snorting drunk because he's afraid to parachute. And so they push him out of the plane with his camera strapped to him, and he lands in the valley, pops up, sees Margaret Hastings, declares her the most beautiful survivor of the war, and starts filming. And incredibly, the film survives. If your listeners would like to see it, it's on my website, mitchellzukoff.com. And there it is, the Rescue from Shangri-La story by Alex Kahn. And in fact, he's the narrator as well.
How about that? You know, I had forgotten about the filmmaker. Just another crazy, exotic element. Now, meanwhile, of course, you know, the war is still going on. I mean, this rescue attempt is happening, but meanwhile, they're fighting for Okinawa and so forth. Now, there's still 2.5 months left of the war in the midst of all of this rescue effort. But I suppose, in a sense, since it kind of began to be fairly obvious to the American public by now that we were going to win the war, we didn't know how expensive it was going to be in terms of materiel and lives lost, but we had a pretty good feeling that the Japanese were on the ropes and we were going to win. So I guess, in a sense, this story became popular because we figured that the big story was about to be wrapped up. This became the human interest story since it was no longer in doubt as to whether we were going to win the big war or not.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a great analysis. I think, who knows what would have happened had this been 1943 instead of 45.
Right.
Yeah, it was a curious and a little bit scary distraction, but it was intriguing for people. And we were feeling good. We had just, in fact, you know, 5 days before this flight, we had just celebrated Victory in Europe Day. Mm-hmm. And so things had, you know, The guys were coming home was the expectation, and so this odd little story in New Guinea became a momentary sensation.
And I suppose to a certain extent, too, that there's sorrow mixed in with this, because here are three people that survived, 21 who didn't, 21 more people who weren't coming home, and they weren't killed in combat, but just in kind of one of those capricious ways that people get killed in a war zone. And the truth is, not everybody who's in uniform gets killed with a gun in one hand and a hand grenade in the other. People get killed in ordinary ways, too. They get killed in Jeep accidents and stupid things like that, just like they would if they were civilians. But, of course, the odds are increased if you're in the middle of a war zone.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's funny. The three survivors ended up feeling like they didn't want to be celebrities because of those 21 who died in such an awful way.
Sure.
It was not a heroic death. It was just a tragedy. And so I think one of the reasons why the story disappeared for so long, and I was fortunate to find it, was that the three survivors weren't looking for any kind of reward, and neither were the heroes, the Earl Walters, the people who jumped in, the glider pilots. I think part of it is a reflection of how different the culture was 67 years ago. Today, Earl Walter would be featured on The Apprentice or on Survivor, I guess.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the ultimate Survivor contestant,
right,
wouldn't it? And people nowadays want to do anything they can to get their name out there. These guys were, frankly, according to your book, seemed kind of embarrassed that anybody made a big deal of it, and they just wanted to go back to their old lives and not be thought of as the beautiful woman who's rescued from paradise and the poor guy who buried his twin in the jungle and so forth. They just wanted to go back to normalcy.
That's exactly it. And they did, and they were determined to do that, and that's exactly what they did. Margaret was put on a bond tour after she came back, and she did her duty and gave talks around the country. But as soon as she could, she was so thrilled to retreat into her private life and just to live a normal life and have a couple of kids. And, you know, every once in a while when a reporter would call her up, she would talk about it, but she did not want this to define her.
It was a very different time and a much different way of looking at celebrity as not something to be chased, that duty and humility were the traits of this greatest generation. And I think that's one of the reasons that we think of them in that way, too. An incredible story, Mitch. And you going over there 65 years after the event to talk to these natives and get their take. And that was fascinating, too, what they thought of all this stuff going on. And it's all there in Lost in Shangri-La, a true story of survival, adventure, and the most incredible rescue mission of World War II from Harper Books. That's an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. To see the film and to find out more about Mitch's book, go to his website, MitchellZukoff.com. That's ZUCKOFF.com. Any last thoughts about the mission or about the survivors or your adventures chasing down the rest of this story?
One last thought is, I guess the most remarkable thing for me is that right now, to this day, the Gremlin Special is still on a mountain on top of in the center of New Guinea. And when I went back to go visit it, it was still there, and I was able to look through a piece of the window that perhaps some of the survivors, some of the victims may have looked at or looked through just before their plane crashed. Mm. And I feel very privileged to have been able to tell their story.
Wow. And it's a wonderful, amazing story. Thank you again, Mitch Zukoff, our guest today on the bookshelf. His book, again, Lost in Shangri-La from Harper Books. And his website, again, MitchellZukoff.com. Mitch, thanks so much. A great story. I'm very excited to get a chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Dave. It's been great.
Are you working on a new book now?
I am. Another World War II story. Another survival story, in fact.
Oh, okay.
This time, it's going to take me to Greenland.
Ooh, that sounds intriguing. From one extreme climate to the other, then.
Exactly. I'm going to go, I'm trying to make a survey of all the big islands.
Excellent. Well, when this book comes out, I definitely want to talk to you again, all right?
I'd love to. Yes,
excellent.
We'll plan on it.
Excellent. Thank you again, Mitch. I really enjoyed it.
Hey, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it.
Our thanks once again to Mitch Zukoff, the author of Lost in Shangri-La from Harper Books. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening to On the Bookshelf, and God bless.